You're listening to the On the NBA Beat podcast, a show packed with nuanced perspectives on the league's most important stories.
Portland has three timeouts left. The Lakers have two. Bryant to Shaq.
LeBron James with no regard for human life.
Jordan. Oh, a spectacular move by Michael Jordan.
And now, your hosts, Lauren Lee Chen, and the twins, Aaron and Joshua Fisher.
Thanks for joining us on the NBA Beat Playoffs Edition. I'm Aaron Fisher. Today's episode will focus solely on the Miami Heat-Charlotte Hornets series. Could be a good series. The first game was very one-sided. Miami ended up winning 123-91. And to delve more deeply into the series, we're bringing on Josh Baumgard, second time on the show, and for the first time, Nick Denning, who writes for AtTheHive.com and is the managing editor of the Lottery Mafia of the Bloggin' Network. He once held the door for Emeka Okafor, but he does lots of other great things for humanity, like write and talk about the Charlotte Hornets and mold young minds as a college English teacher. We're proud to unveil a new format we're experimenting with, in which we're going to divide the show into two halves. And we'll start with the Josh Baumgard part of the interview. Then after the break, stay tuned. We'll listen to Nick Denning talk about the series and what Charlotte has to do to get back into it. Let's bring in Josh now. How's it going, Josh?
What's up, fellas?
Not much. We're excited to talk about the Heat and Hornets. After a dominant first game effort by the Miami Heat, the Charlotte Hornets are hoping to make this a series by stealing one in Miami. I'm curious your thoughts as to if the Hornets have much of a chance. They were 25-9 the last 2.5 months of the season. They're a really deep, quality team, but Miami's also playing lights-out basketball, and they won convincingly in Game 1. What do you think about that?
I don't want to overreact too much. I know the media, we in general, have a tendency to react on a game-by-game basis.
But yeah, fans too.
I think it's silly, you know? Yeah, fans too, but I think that's part of social media's lore. But you got to relax about that a little bit. I mean, they blow them out, they look convincing, but as we've seen in years past, like, a team can win game one and lose the next four. Like, it's just, I need three or four games to really assess a trend and how one team matches up with another. But I fully expect the Hornets to come out swinging and playing a lot harder in game two. Now, I think the Heat will still come away with it. They play really well on their home court, but this isn't going to be a cakewalk. I highly doubt it's going to be a dominating sweep.
And we saw in the Mavericks-Thunder series, and I don't want to compare because it's just a totally different animal and a different matchup, but the Mavericks just got absolutely destroyed in game one, and then they come out in game two in Oklahoma City and they win one. And this Charlotte Hornets team is a quality team. We can't forget that.
No, absolutely. They are. They're a really good team. And you have to look at some of these shooting numbers, like Luol Deng and Hassan Whiteside combined 20 for 24. That's not happening. And if it does happen, then it's going to be another blowout. But I don't think Luol Deng's hit 4 for 6 from 3 every game. The Heat in general, I don't think they're hitting 50% from three. Charlotte has a really good defense. Yeah, this one should be a lot closer tomorrow.
Some of these stats, I'm wondering if you think they're sustainable. You mentioned the crazy shooting percentages from Deng and Whiteside, but also the rebounding disparity and the fact that the Heat only had 6 turnovers. Do you think that's sustainable?
No, because I think Charlotte's going to ramp up their intensity. With that, it's going to come more turnovers. The Heat aren't going to shoot as well. I think they're really going to come at Whiteside. They know he has a tendency to let his temper flare. And I think you're going to see next game. I think Jefferson's going to pound him. I think they might even bring Hansborough in for a little longer just to kind of be that goon, because we all know he can get under players' skin. And he seems like the logical guy to try to bait Whiteside if they're into that sort of thing. And it's the NBA playoffs, you know, like, they leave everything out there. And if I'm Charlotte, I would, if things aren't going so well, I'd put Hansborough out there, beat him up a little bit.
It seems like they have to do something a little bit extreme. And again, I don't want to overstate the importance of just a single game, but the rebounding disparity was so vast. So I know that it's not likely sustainable that it will be that great of a disparity, at least in my opinion. And some of those shooting numbers for, let's say, Whiteside and Dang, who each only missed two shots, that's not sustainable. But they won by 32. Are the overall trends, do you think, likely to keep up? Just that they'll control the boards, barring any foul trouble or ejection or something crazy?
Yeah, I mean, as long as it's crazy as I know, they shot, there was a huge free throw disparity, and you don't often see a team lose by 32 and outshoot the other team from the line by 16 attempts. So that's even more interesting, because if that was a little more balanced out, then it could have been even worse than 32-point spread. But yeah, I think the Heat are a better team. I think they've got more firepower in the playoffs. They've got multiple guys to create. And as long as these guys play together, which they have, as long as Dwayne Wade doesn't try to be the man, which he's an unselfish guy, he buys into the team aspect, as long as he tries to not do too much hero ball and they're moving the ball, that's the key with them. When they're moving the ball and they're playing hard defense, they can pretty much hang with anybody, at least in the Eastern Conference.
I read a lot of series previews before Game 1, and many insiders noted that the Hornets have the advantage in depth. How would you assess that argument?
No, I think that's foolish. Maybe argue they're a little deeper at like 9 or 10, but I mean, the Heat with those two rookies off the bench, I don't think a lot of people realize how impactful they've been, at least from on the national scene. Like, Winslow and Richardson have been just essential to them. Winslow, his defense, you know, Wade and Johnson are dinosaurs in NBA years. They can't chase guys around the perimeter like they used to. They can crank up the defensive intensity when they need to, but they're really not in the same league as Justice Winslow as a defender on the perimeter right now. Josh Richardson, he hustles his tail off on the defensive end, and his shooting has been just huge. Like, I remember talking to you guys last time. I think we were talking about how poorly shooting they were as a team, and Richardson, Johnson, those guys have been huge, and they're coming off the bench. You know, I know Stoudemire doesn't come off the bench anymore. I mean, Whiteside doesn't come off the bench anymore, but even Omari's given you a solid 10 to 15 minutes, you know, so they're top eight. I think they're pretty deep. And then you have like Josh McRoberts and Haslam and those guys if needed for spot minutes. And even Darrell Wright, I mean, he played 4 minutes last game and he came away with, 8 points?
Wow.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. If you hadn't, I was going to mention Darrell Wright and Josh McRoberts. These are guys that are maybe number 10 on the roster, and they're even capable of contributing, which they showed in game one. So it's a very deep roster.
Yeah, they're deep. They're deep in their balance. You know, not, you could say like they may not be as deep in the tail end or their bench, but their 4 and 5 is probably better than most other teams' 4 and 5. You know, depending on how you look at it, you can consider Dwayne Wade the 3rd or 4th best player on this team. Some people would say that's crazy, and they could say Dragic or Whiteside, but you've got a very balanced top 6, 7 guys.
Yeah. Kemba Walker is one guy who I think needs to have a big series, especially scoring the basketball. And you'd want him to distribute as well, but I think 19 points isn't going to get it done for the Hornets moving forward, and that he needs to put up closer to 30. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, I think so. I think Kemba's one of those guys that's very inconsistent. And I think the Heat, I think they really enjoy playing those guys. They'd much rather play a ball-dominant guy like Kemba that's flashy and a high-volume shooter than one of these lights-out three-point shooters. So I think the Heat are going to do everything they can to contain him, and I think you're going to see a lot of Winslow on him, especially in the second half, just because he's versatile, and although Kemba's a lot smaller, he might be, I don't know, a little quicker, but Winslow's got such amazing defensive agility, and I think he could really give Kemba some issues. And yeah, I mean, I think Kemba's got to be lights out for them to have a chance to beat them, especially tomorrow.
This might be a little bit hard for you to say because the Heat did win pretty easily in Game 1, but were there stretches where you saw the Hornets were going to something that was working, or possibly an area of vulnerability for the Heat that the Hornets should go to more the rest of the series?
I mean, as crazy as it sounds, I think Hassan Whiteside's a bit vulnerable inside. He's got great off-the-ball defense, and he's a tremendous shot blocker, but he's had some issues guarding guys in the post. And if you look at the numbers, I couldn't tell you off the top of my head, but they certainly reflect that. You saw, who was it? Robin Lopez, like some of the true post scorers in the league, like Lopez, have given him issues, and Al Jefferson is just a monster inside. I know he's a bit fatter and older than we're used to seeing, and I feel like he's always dominated the Heat, but I think Jefferson's got a 30-point game in him, and if I were the Hornets, I would dump it into him on Whiteside just all day, because, you know, he might block some shots for sure, but if you can get Whiteside in some foul trouble, the Heat are a different team defensively when he's out of the game.
It could tire him out, too.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Whiteside is going to be playing full tilt tomorrow. He's pissed because he didn't win Defensive Player of the Year, and I don't know if that's warranted. I think it's fair to say he was the third best defensive player in the league this year, and maybe may have even been fourth. But
yeah, we were talking about that before.
He's going to be coming out firing tomorrow. Yeah, he's going to look for that. He's going to look for that triple double with blocks. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, we were talking about that before the show. That three is probably a good spot for him, even though he's just such a dominant shot blocker. Hard to go wrong though with those two guys at the top. Such great defenders on great team defense.
Yeah, and they're elite. They're just so elite. And Whiteside, you still watch him even the other night in the blowout. You'll just see him, and he just doesn't. He gives up a rebound, and it's not because of effort. He just didn't box out. So he's got a few more things he needs to sharpen up on to really be among the league's overall elite defenders.
And I think Whiteside would have ran away with the Sixth Man of the Year award had he started a few fewer games.
Right. No, absolutely.
A lot of people are saying that the Heat's success was contingent upon Chris Bosh staying healthy and doing well. But as we know, he hasn't been around because of various issues. How do you think his absence has allowed for some Heat players to play more to their strengths? Whiteside, for example, or Dragic even, to be able to control the ball more?
I think it's a testament to the Heat's coaching, but also their balance. Because if Bosh was, let's say, I don't know, shooting 20% of the team shots before, they had some other guys that could have been using a little more volume, a little more looks. Whiteside was one of them. So they've really picked up, and I'm absolutely not saying they're better without Bosh. I think anybody would be silly to say that. I mean, he's such a good two-way player. But yeah, they've all stepped up, and it appears that this group outside of Bosh, they really thrive playing small ball, especially Luol Deng. It's like Luol Deng was reborn when he was moved to the four. Like, he's just a completely different player. When he was playing the three and he was really on the outside and going against other threes, like, he looked washed up. He looked done. I said to trade him to China, like, bring back Michael Beasley. But ever since he's gone to the four, it's just reinvigorated everything. Like, Goran Dragic has been more aggressive, has gotten more shots. So, I mean, yeah, they've just stepped up in his absence, and that's what you expect from a bunch of veteran, former, and current stars.
Speaking of Bosh, is it just really unpredictable now whether or not he'll return at some point? And if he does, what would that do to the chemistry? Obviously, they know him. They've played with him. He's a great player that, of course, you would add if you had the opportunity to.
Yeah, it'd be very interesting. I mean, I don't, if I'm him, I'd agree that he's got something within him where he's prone to blood clots, and that doesn't really mesh well with the NBA lifestyle. You can't play on blood thinners, which I think he wanted to do, and the Heat didn't let him, even though that wasn't officially confirmed or anything. But that was the kind of the mindset of the local media around here, thinking that they're on different pages, the team and Bosh. But if he were to come back, you'd have to find a way to work him in. Now, it might not be a ton of minutes of Bosh and Whiteside next to each other. You might have to stagger them more, and maybe Whiteside, maybe Bosh. Like, see, Whiteside cares about starting. He cares about these little things that probably Chris Bosh can go without. I think Bosh would just be satisfied coming back. And I think, as crazy as it sounds, with him making over $20 million a year, I think he'd be cool coming off the bench. And he'd be playing coming in as that five for Whiteside. And they'd both play, I don't know, 30 minutes a game and overlap a little bit. But yeah, I think they can find a way to make it work. The key is, when you have Bosh and Whiteside together, you need some more shooting around them. You know, and that might not mesh well with Dwayne Wade, but if Wade comes out and he throws some other guys, yeah, mm-hmm. They'll find a way to incorporate him if he's able to come back. I hope he is, but there's a part of me that hopes he just retires because he's got his money's worth. He's got nothing left to prove.
I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. It could be a long series, but the Heat seem to have a good path going forward to potentially get to the Eastern Conference Finals with maybe...
Heat and four. You're talking Cleveland Heat and four. I'm going to save your breath. Right there.
I actually wasn't going to ask you that, but it's good to know. We can revisit that later, but But yeah, so if they win this series against the Hornets, then they're going to take on either the Raptors or Pacers. Neither of those teams seems that strong. There are clear weaknesses. The Heat are looking good right now. But do you want to make a prediction for the rest of this series, if you're comfortable with it?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think they get past Charlotte relatively easy. I'm thinking five games. I thought five before the series started. There'll be a game where they're not going to be shooting well, and that's where they'll be vulnerable. But I think they get past them in five, and as you said, that next round matchup is neither of those teams have a ton of firepower, and they don't seem to be as balanced as the Heat. 1-7, 1-8. The Heat just, they have so much veteran experience, you know, and I don't think Paul George is enough if the Pacers got there to tilt it in their favor.
I told you this when we were setting up the interview, but I think it's cool that you're our first two-time guest, and it wasn't a coincidence. We did it for a reason. We love having you on and talking Heat, and they're really an intriguing team this year. It'll be interesting to see how far they go.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate it. Yeah, they really are, and not to say this just because I'm a hometown guy here, but they're intriguing because we don't really know what they are yet. Everybody thought they were done when Bosch went down, and here they are, and they've got some intriguing pieces. So
yeah,
I think everybody's really looking forward and really hoping that Miami meets Cleveland in these finals. And though they'll probably not win, it would be a heck of an entertaining clash.
Yeah, what a great storyline that would be.
So much fun, yeah. The media, like, it would just be nuts. And the thing is, the pressure would seem to be all on Cleveland in that scenario, because the Heat aren't supposed to be Cleveland in that series, and then the pressure is all on LeBron, so it would be a highly watched event to see that.
Thanks again, Josh. Enjoy Game 2 and the rest of the series.
Thanks, guys. Anytime.
Hey, Nick.
Hey, how's it going?
Well, it's good to have you on. This series with the Heat, it's going to be a tough one. They got blown out in Game 1, but these Hornets are a very solid, deep team. What's your mindset right now in where the Hornets are and what they have to do moving forward to be able to find a way to advance?
You know, I haven't quite hit the panic button yet. I know some have, but I'd say the biggest thing that needs to change is really that they have to kind of get back more of their, you know, I guess their identity, specifically on the defensive rebounding side of things. I mean, Miami got a ton of offensive rebounds in Game 1, and Charlotte ranked as the best defensive rebounding team in the league, so that was very unlike them to give up so many offensive rebounds. That's got to improve, and I think part of that is containing Whiteside, which they had a real trouble doing in Game 1. So that, to me, is probably the first thing they need to do.
Do you think that that's an easy fix for them? The rebounding disparity, that just can't happen, right?
No, it can't. It's interesting because they, in Game 1, they did, on pick and roll situations, they started blitzing in those pick and roll situations, and it left guys wide open, either underneath the basket, you know, or you saw Luol Deng open from the three. It just kind of really, you know, discombobulated them defensively, and it was very unlike, you know, what I've seen from them throughout the season. It's interesting that how they've been so good from a defensive rebounding standpoint without really having an elite rebounder. I mean, Zeller is pretty good. Jefferson is good. He gets good positioning at least. But, you know, they've just always known how to, you know, Clifford's done just a good job of being able to coach a unit defensively and have them just, you know, practice good defensive rebounding principles. So I think just kind of going back to what's worked during the season should hopefully make things better for them in Game 2.
The Heat put up the most points in their playoff history last game. Obviously, there needs to be a defensive adjustment for the Hornets, but you already mentioned limiting the Heat's offensive rebounding. They were able to parlay that into a huge percentage in the points in the paint. They scored on 22 of their 29 shots in the restricted area. Other than that, what do you think is the biggest defensive adjustment needed for the Hornets?
Sort of alluded to this just earlier, but their rotations were just so out of whack. And I mean, Luol Deng found himself, you know, just for one example, just found himself wide open time after time, especially from the corner. And I mean, he had such a great game. And I think just, you know, They asked the Heat about, you know, Deng's performance in game one. They said, you know, what did you do? And they said, well, we didn't really do anything different. You're still getting the same shots he always does. So to me, that says, okay, they can fix this. You know, it's not like Deng was doing something differently. You know, just better rotations, maybe bad, just, like I said, kind of get back to the more, you know, principles that have worked rather than trying something that, you know, clearly didn't in the first game.
From an offensive perspective, is Kemba Walker going to have to do a lot more for them to have a good chance at coming back?
Only if the rest of the, you know, the role players in the Hornets continue to perform poorly, because, you know, he actually had a pretty good game. 19 points is, I mean, obviously below his season average, but, you know, he shot the ball fairly well. He kind of took the shots that came to him. And Batum had a good game as well. But, you know, Marvin Williams, who's been very reliable throughout the season, was just non-existent. Courtney Lee missed some shots. They didn't get a lot of production from some of the other guys that have been known that they've been able to rely on in the past. So unless, you know, I think Walker can do more, but I wouldn't necessarily say they have to rely on him unless, you know, they just continue to not get anything else from the role players.
And if the role players aren't really doing that much and Kemba Walker has to shoulder more of the load, do you anticipate seeing Justice Winslow potentially put on him? I know he's bigger and Kemba Walker's faster, but Winslow is a really good, versatile defender. And Josh Baumgart talked about that we might see more of Winslow on Kemba Walker.
It's a possibility, especially, you know, and let's say that Lynn and Walker play together, which you may not see as much because if Lynn has to guard Wade, that's an issue. But you got to think, you know, if Lynn and Walker are out in the court at the same time, you could see a situation where maybe someone like Josh Richardson is guarding Lynn and then Walker's guarded by Winslow. It won't be good if the role players don't step up and start hitting shots, because, you know, people talk about Kemba's, you know, improved shooting percentages this year. Part of that is he adjusted his release, but part of that is the fact that there are just other reliable scorers on the floor now. You know, in years past, everything that, you know, like almost every time late in the shot clock, the ball had to go to Walker, whether he was in a good position to shoot or not. And that's why he had to put up a lot of just bad, you know, shots. And this year he hasn't had to do that. So you could see things going south pretty quickly if he has to be relied on to do, you know, almost everything.
And I know you said that you're not ready to hit the panic button yet. I think Steve Clifford feels the same way. He said he's not going to change their game plan too much. Especially, he said that he's not really going to think about starting Al Jefferson over Zeller. But do you think that Jefferson's post presence is needed in a series like this to go against a guy like Hassan Whiteside and make life a little bit harder for him inside?
Absolutely. I mean, I think Jefferson's their X factor, just because even though he hasn't been at quite the level he's been, you know, maybe say from 2 years ago, in recent weeks, he's looked a lot better. He's looked healthier. His post moves have been much stronger. So I was really disappointed just by how poorly he played for the most part in game one. Whether he starts or not, I don't think necessarily matters. But, like, I think you made a good point saying, like, he can potentially disrupt Whiteside. And if he can kind of get him into foul trouble, that could, you know, that could bode well. But yeah, he needs to do more.
Despite the one-sided score, were there some things you saw from the Hornets that were encouraging, possibly somewhere where the Heat were vulnerable in game one?
They didn't really have an answer for Batum. I was actually a little bit worried just by how he would perform, just because he was coming off. He just rolled his ankle about a week and a half ago. He played really well. And, you know, you could just tell that he had been in these situations before. He was ready for a playoff game. I also like the way Zeller played, just because he found himself in a lot of open spaces, and he's really good at kind of playing off the ball, particularly when Batum's on the floor. Batum just kind of knows where he's gonna run on the floor. He got a lot of easy kind of dunks, just kind of driving, you know, diving to the hoop. And then, like, you know, like I said before, I thought Walker played fairly well, and, you know, I wasn't too concerned about that. But yeah, that was probably the only real positives, from the first game.
Yeah, it seems like Batum is one of the more experienced players on this roster, at least from a playoffs perspective.
Yeah, he is. And I think that was probably one reason that they brought him over. He's just so kind of, he's very cool and calm when he's out there. He doesn't get, too extreme emotionally one way or another. But he's just so smart. I mean, like, you know, the first, you know, when they were down early in the game, I think they were down maybe 9-2 or something like that, or 9-1. And, you know, he kind of came, he rolled off a screen. He knew that his defender was trailing him. And he, you know, he does this all, he's done this all season, but he's able to draw a foul on a 3-point attempt just because he kind of can shift his body into the defender who's trailing, trying to catch up, and they kind of just run into each other. And just things like that are just, you know, just smart plays that he's able to do just because he just reads the game so well. But one thing I'd say he has to do more, and Walker as well, is just combined they only had like, and I don't, this may not be exactly correct, but it's around this area. They only had about 2 assists combined. It was either 2 or 5 assists combined, and that is not enough. Part of that is the fact that the other guys on the team weren't exactly hitting their shots, but that needs to improve.
Yeah, actually, you were saying Kemba Walker and Batum?
Yeah.
Yeah, they only combined for 2 assists and 5 turnovers also. So they did get a lot of points, but no one else was scoring. You're right about that. And when you look at the Hornets and the Heat's record during the regular season, obviously they both were 48 and 34, just like Atlanta and Boston. But the Hornets weren't that good of a road team, and the Heat were a very good home team. I know it's kind of hard for us to talk about home and away and really what's the difference, but the Hornets are going to be in a hostile atmosphere again, and they're going to need to find a way to dig deep. Is part of that just not getting blown out early, just hanging around, and then as you hang around longer, progressively building that confidence?
That's an interesting question, because like the Hornets kind of do, you know, they do one or two things typically at the start of games. They either get out to really good starts and they usually roll for most of the game. Or there's been times where they've had starts like that one in game one. And you're just like, wow, they just didn't show up today. And then around the end of the second quarter, into the third quarter, they just start to make a run. And then suddenly they're back in it by the start of the fourth quarter. And like, I think the Spurs game is a great example of that. I mean, they didn't even score. I think he said 9 or 11 points in the first quarter, and then they came back and won. So I don't know. To say, like, you know, they definitely need to hang around. The playoffs are a different thing. But, you know, I think probably for game two, just based on how game one went, I think they have to get off to a good start. Because I think if they get behind again, like they have at, you know, at times this season, it's going to be much harder for them to come back just because of the situation.
I think one surprising thing for the Hornets this season that didn't get a lot of national coverage was the play of Marvin Williams over the course of the season. He was really strong for them throughout, and he did a lot of little things well that helped the team. But in game one, he struggled a lot, especially shooting. How much do they need a good game from him at least, and what can he do to make that better?
It's really important that he plays better. There have been times this season where I'd say he was the third most important scorer on the floor, just because, you know, he's, you know, at times this season, he was just so good in kind of catch and shoot opportunities. And he was, you know, he would just really spread the floor out, you know, because, if, you know, with Batum and Walker out there, you have to obviously focus on them. But if he's hitting, but then if Marvin Williams is hitting shots, it just opens up space for some, you know, for those two and for others. He needs to have a good game, because if he plays well, it just opens up things for just everybody else.
We want to get your prediction, if you're comfortable giving one. Do you have a thought as to how the rest of the series will go?
It's going to, if they win tomorrow and they tie the series up, this can go any direction. Because I said coming into the series that they had to split the first two if they really wanted to have a shot at winning this. Because, you know, they split the first two, they can kind of gain some kind of home court advantage. If they lose tomorrow, I mean, I could see it being over, you know, maybe in 5 games. Coming out of a 2-0 hole was very difficult. And I think Miami, just with all the experience that team has, you know, in the playoffs, I just don't see them blowing a 2-0 lead. Yeah.
It's a shame when two hot teams meet up in the playoffs. And I know this is not on as big of a scale, but it reminds me a little bit of the Spurs Clippers last year. I mean, those teams each won 14 of their last 15, and it was a shame that the Spurs had to be eliminated in the first round. Both of these teams were so strong after the All-Star break, and it's a shame that one can't be playing next round. You'd at least hope for the series to go a little bit longer than what you said, but we'll see what happens. You're right. If they don't come out strong in game two, then it's going to be difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and you're right. I mean, these teams have played well, and it's amazing what they've kind of overcome. I mean, you think about Miami with losing Bosch. Charlotte, you know, thought they had lost Michael Kidd-Gilchrist all season. Then he comes back. They go like 5-2 in the 7 games he plays. They look so, I mean, they just, you just see the impact that he has. And then he tears his labrum again. And you're just like, I mean, what, you know, part of me just wonders, we all, I think every Hornets fan and follower wonders, you know, wonders just if he had been healthy, even for just half the games, like what, how many more wins could this team have had? Because he just provides such an impact on both ends.
Yeah, you and I worked together at the Lottery Mafia, so this wasn't the first time we were on a podcast together, but it was your first time on the NBA beat, and we really appreciate it. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Good luck to your Hornets, and I hope we see an entertaining series. We'll see what happens, though.